You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Daily Times published its first edition on September 18, 1851. It was a four-page broadsheet, and it cost just one penny. Well, a lot has changed since then. Today, it's published in four colors. It's smaller and has fewer columns. And the news it reports is practically up to the minute. Bill Keller is here to talk about the changing face of journalism that's reflected on the front page of America's most respected newspaper. Besides being the executive editor of the New York Times, he's a contributor to a new book containing 300 of his paper's most important front pages. The New York Times, the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008, is published by Black Dog and Leventhal, and I'm delighted that it has brought Bill Keller back to the show. Hi.
Thanks for inviting me.
When was the word daily dropped out of the name? There was a hyphen, too.
There was a hyphen, and there was a period at the end of it. And I don't remember, you know, Tom Bodkin, who's the art director at the Times, has this wonderful slideshow he does showing the various iterations of the Times over the years, starting with the dash and the period. And at the end of the slide, he has one that he's put on that's a hologram, and the pictures actually leap out at you, which is his vision of what the front page might look like in the future. I don't remember, you know, what the great turning points were for the typography. But, you know, it's certainly one of the stunning things about this book is how much the paper has evolved.
Yeah, we think of it as being this constant. What about all the news that's fit to print? How early was that added?
I don't. You could give me a pop quiz on all of the dates in the book, and I'd probably fail it. My role in this book was to read the 300 page part, and then there's 54,000 pages that are in three CDs that come with it. And to write an introduction. So
as an editor, was it fun looking at all of those pages? Because there are three CDs, as you said, and then there are 300 pages that were chosen for the book. In looking over some of those other pages, were you surprised, or did you think, hey, we've been doing our job all along?
I found it fascinating. We've done these books in the past, but you normally get maybe 100 pages at the max, and to even just the 300 pages without plugging in the CD into your computer is great, because it's a little less selective than just, you know every book of these has Men Walk on Moon and the assassinations and the start of wars and the end of wars. But in this one, you actually get some of the stuff that happens between the beginning and the end of the war. There's the sort of dailiness of life, which I found really fascinating.
And that was something I was curious about, because in the 300 pages, we do get the Emancipation Proclamation, we get Kennedy's assassination, the moon landing, things you knew had to be included. But then there are these things you'd expect to see, like the bombing of Hiroshima. It's not there. Mm-hmm. It's in the CDs, but not in the printed book, or the liberation of the first concentration camp. Mm-hmm. You have any idea why not?
It was just, 300 sounds like a lot, but when you're down to final choices, it's not that many out of 54,000 front pages. And I think there was a conscious desire to not just hit the obvious high points.
Now, how important is the front page? Is this like a magazine? Magazines will sometimes report that they sold more issues because of the cover. Do people buy newspapers that way?
I think not, certainly not in the case of the Times, because only a small portion of our sales is actually newsstand sales where that would make a difference. Most of our sales are to subscribers who are going to get it regardless of what's on the front page.
And was that always the case? The Work Street, read all about it. Was that other newspapers, or did the Times do that as well?
No, in the early days, I think more attention was paid, although, the early days of the New York Times, the paper looked so gray and sedate. Nowadays we have maybe six stories on the front page and refers to a few other things inside. In the early days, it was as if every story was on the front page.
No pictures, so you had more space to put all those stories.
That's true. And no bylines to take up space in those days either. Those didn't arrive until really the 20th century.
It used to read special to the New York Times, actually, until fairly recently in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody gets a byline.
Pretty much. Sometimes multiple bylines on a story.
And you weren't part of that decision, but you must have thought about why that approach is special to the New York Times. I guess that suggests that the paper is primary, whereas the byline suggests that the reporter is the key factor.
Right. Well, it's partly that. I mean, I think there is a notion of collective responsibility behind this special to the New York Times, and you still see it. The Economist, for example, doesn't use bylines. Their things are all written as if they were the voice of God. I was not involved in the decision to start doing bylines, but I've been involved in a number of decisions about, for example, whether or not you allow multiple bylines, which until pretty recently we didn't.
You've had a byline, and then underneath the article you've said so-and-so and so-and-so also contributed to the preparation of this article.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there is an element of ego in the byline. It makes reporters happy to have their name on the story, and I can't deny that. There's also an element of accountability. I think it's useful to tell the readers not only who was writing it, but where they were when they wrote it. There are reporters who become sort of marquee names. I think, you know, just as people have favorite tenors and baritones when they go to the opera, I think there are serious newspaper readers who say, oh, look, that's an Adam Nagorny story. I think I'll read that one.
I have favorite reporters. Mm-hmm. And then there are other ones where I've had problems with the reporting personally in the past, and I'm not sure I want to read it. The same way that I might read a review of a film. One critic I might trust more than another.
Right.
And that's something that was eliminated when it was special to the New York Times. I would have had no idea whether it was this reporter or that reporter doing it.
Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, there's more, critics aside, movie critics aside, there is more judgment that goes into a newspaper story these days, because the raw facts of a story are up on the website and a lot of websites all day long. So the newspaper has a little more of a responsibility to try and get behind the facts. And in that case, you really want to know whose judgments those are.
My guest is Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times. And whenever anything goes wrong, people do come to you to find out why it went wrong. Your public editor columns regularly have, well, Bill Keller felt it was such and such. And you're called to task every time there's a problem, aren't you? Involved do you get in those things? You don't read every article before it goes to print, do you?
No. I mean, you know, one reason that the front page is a disproportionately important part of the paper is that it's how we organize our day. There's a kind of slow process of competition for the front page. Editors bring in stories that they pitch. And that's about as much of the paper as you can consume in advance and give it any serious attention to.
Well, you say the life of a newspaper revolves around making up the front page. How do you decide each day which stories will make the front page, or as you put it in your introduction, be fronted?
Be fronted. Yeah.
That's the jargon of the newspaper?
Yeah, that's the jargon. Well, some things are obvious. I mean, sometimes the news prescribes what's going to be on the front page. If there's a stock market crash or a war or, an important person dies or somebody discovers a cure for cancer, you know that's going to be a front page story. Others are kind of dictated by the flow of events. These days, almost every day, we're going to be looking for a front page story about the economy. And on days when there isn't an obvious event, we're looking for a smart take from Main Street or from inside a particular business or the regulatory agencies that will help readers understand it. Sometimes things are just there because they're pretty damn interesting.
Well, for example, today's paper, we have the kinds of stories we expect, but there's also a large piece on Phil Graham, a blurb, what you call a refer, about a 12-year-old boy who reviews restaurants. There's a piece on bodyguards in Mexico, but not the fact that Japan has gone into recession, or no story on the fires in California, which got a lot of play on television and radio.
Right. Both the Japanese economy and the fires in California have gotten front page treatment. Everybody saw the Japanese recession coming, I think, and so we've written about that. The fires.
So you don't want to do it again and again.
You don't want to do it over and over again. Say, you know, what we told you yesterday was going to happen, in fact, happened. If you've got something more interesting, there's a story in the paper about the Japanese going into recession. It's just not on the front page. The fires we've done, you know, we did over the weekend, both a lot of stories and front page pictures. And in fact, Sunday the front of the national page had a 6-column wonderful picture from the fires. So, you know, if you just said we're going to do the 6 most important things today, you would have, you know, what happened in the economy, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, world hunger. You know, I mean, pick your 6 cosmic issues that are always the most 6 most important things.
So who goes into making the decision?
A bunch of editors sit around a table. The national editor comes in with a menu of things that she thinks ought to be on the front page. The foreign editor brings the things she thinks ought to be on the front page. We discuss it a bit, and in the end, the buck stops here. Although I like to pass the buck around the table a little bit first.
And some days you take off, I'm sure.
And some days I take off.
But it's changed a lot over the years. There used to be many more editions, and every front page changed as a result, trying to keep up with the stories. Now you have 2 editions, basically. But you also have your internet newspaper.
Right.
And that is changing constantly. So is the front page as important today as it might have been in the past? Because I can just go to the New York Times page on the internet and find out, see a whole different front page than the one that I got in my when it was delivered this morning.
That's right. Yeah, we have basically a front page every minute. If you look at the home page of the website.
So the front page is being replaced by the home page.
At this point, they operate, I would say, in parallel, and they serve different functions. For the most part, people go to the home page to find out, you know, how a story they're following has developed. The day may come when people decide that the website is the way they consume the whole newspaper, but I think we're not quite there yet. The printed newspaper is still profitable. It still has a very devoted readership with a median age in its 40s, so I think that habit's not going to die anytime soon. And for the printed newspaper, the front page is still really our kind of organizing principle.
How much does the front page reflect changes in the Times readership over the years? Has it always been around 40 years old, or was it older at one point?
It may have been older, or may have been younger at one point. I don't know. I know it's been pretty constant the last couple of times it's been measured. Let's say over the last 10 or 15 years, it's been kind of 45, 48, something like that.
One of the big debates has been over what a newspaper actually should be doing these days, with the fact that we can go to any number of news sources on the internet, and then we have radio and television. We can see the pictures of something happening at this moment. So I'm sure that's something that has been argued about constantly within the confines of the newspaper. Have you come to any conclusion about how you want to proceed these days?
We think about that a lot. It's kind of the great existential question of, you know, whether newspapers survive, and a lot of them are not surviving.
We're cutting back so much that they practically are not
hollow.
Not much better than these giveaways that we get at the subway.
That's right. I mean, I think, look, I'm not an economist, but, I studied enough to know the law of supply and demand. And I think the demand for what newspapers do, not just raw information, but information sorted in some sense with a sense of priorities and that's explained a bit, and news that digs behind the obvious to find the stuff people don't want you to know. There's a huge demand for that, and it's evident by the huge traffic that we get on our website and that other news websites get. I would say the supply is actually diminished. There are more and more news sources, but I consume an awful lot of them myself. I watch TV. I'm on the internet much of the day, it feels like. But, you know, 99.9% of the websites that you run across don't do actual reporting. They opine or they're very specialized, you know, for people who are fascinated by a, you know, hobbyist in a particular subject, or they exchange feelings about child rearing or subjects like that. But the actual sources of genuine reporting are rare. You know, you can almost name, you can name a few of them, but not very many.
Although the New York Times also has its many reporters doing blogs these days.
That's true. That's true. But we have, you know, we have a newsroom of upwards of 1,200 journalists, reporters, editors, photographers, and so on, who actually go out and report news. You know, we have a Baghdad bureau, which I don't think any bloggers have, although there are some bloggers in Baghdad.
My guest is Bill Keller, who is executive editor of the New York Times. And we're talking about a huge book. I don't know how heavy this book is, but it is
8 pounds.
And it's a huge, large format. It's not the size of a front page of the New York Times, but it's the closest I think you could come with the normal publishing, under normal publishing circumstances. It is quite large. The complete front page is 1851 to 2008, actually 300 in print and the rest on CDs. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Bill Keller, who is executive editor of the New York Times, talking about a book called The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008. And it has essays from some of the Times' most famous writers, Richard Bernstein, Ethan Bronner, Roger Cohn, Gail Collins, Elaine Cooper, Thomas Friedman, William Grimes, Karen James, Gina Collada, David Leonard, Steve Lohr, Frank Rich, Carla Ann Robbins. Once I start reading them, I have to read them all. Gene Roberts, William Sapphire, Serge Schmiman, Sam Tenenhouse, and John Noble Wilford. That covers science and medicine and literature and pretty much everything else, but also the op-ed.
You could put out a pretty good newspaper just with those people, actually.
Yes. And it's interesting to watch how they move around. For example, Gail Collins used to be an editorial writer on the editorial board, and now she writes one of the most popular of your op-ed pieces. Mm-hmm. But this is not the front page, but I am curious about op-ed, why it has become such an important part of a newspaper. I don't remember op-ed pieces being all that important in the Times of the past, although you always had some very famous commentators.
I'm really glad you asked that question because it gives me a chance to say something that that readers of the Times, including sophisticated readers of the Times, don't know, which is that I have nothing to do with the editorial page and the op-ed page.
But
although like Gail, I did a tour on the during a what I think of as a very happy 20 months of exile from the newsroom, wrote a column for the op-ed page.
But the public editor receives so many complaints about misinformation in op-ed columns, and this is part of the problem with a newspaper. People read a paper like the New York Times for information, and if I, as a person with a political axe to grind, make certain claims, am I held to the same standards that a journalist is if I'm writing them on the op-ed page? And should the op-ed page insist on a columnist getting all the facts right?
I think they do try to insist on the columnist getting their facts right. Of course, they have tremendous license when it comes to how they interpret those facts, much more license than the people who work for me. And we, you know, one thing that we do talk a lot about around the paper, Andy Rosenthal, who edits the editorial page and oversees the op-ed columns, and I discuss this a fair amount, is how we distinguish, particularly online, where these things tend to flow together and become indistinguishable, how we distinguish what is somebody's opinion from what is being presented as objective reporting. You know, it's partly how you label it and how you package it. You know, you can't divide things quite so rigorously online where you don't want to divide them too rigorously because, if somebody's reading an article about the bailout on Wall Street, you want them to be able to click from that to a variety of opinions about the bailout on Wall Street without losing track of where they are.
Do you find yourself constantly having to deal with perceived biases? Because, again, the public editor's column has to deal with that all the time. What was placed on the New York, on the front page, becomes a major consideration. Does mm-hmm. that, the article was about Barack Obama, and then the one on John McCain was inside, yes, you gave them equal space, but you gave one the more prominent position. I'm using right. that just as a possible example. And people are reading those kinds of things all the time.
That's not just a possible example. That's a constant example. We get those, how many times we had McCain's picture on the front page versus Obama's picture.
Did you count them?
When somebody raised the question, we did. We don't sort of day by day say, oh, we had McCain today, we have to have Obama tomorrow. You try to pick the picture that's the best picture and one that's sort of on the news. One of the problems that arose during this presidential campaign was we devoted a lot of investigative resources to looking into Barack Obama early on because he was new, not very well known, and we sent people to Chicago, and we wrote about Tony Rezko, and we wrote about his record in the Illinois Senate, and so on. We wrote about Bill Ayers. We did all that stuff sort of early on, and then a lot of time passed, and McCain was the nominee, and we devoted a lot of investigative resources to looking into McCain. And the public editor and I received lots of complaints from conservatives and Republicans that we were, day after day going after McCain, but Obama, where was he? Where was the investigator? And, it's a legitimate question to raise. We had done it, but we'd done it early on.
But aren't you also darned if you do, darned if you don't? Because many people complain that Barack Obama was an unknown quantity. And if newspapers didn't spend any time looking into his past, the positive and the negative, if it was all positive, if it was all hagiography, well, then I could see a real complaint. But if you do tell us about any candidate's past, and then people complain that you spent too much time talking about it, although they would have complained that you didn't tell us about it,
sure.
you're caught in some kind of bind, aren't you? I know
sure.
I think about that a lot on this show.
Sure. And we get it, we get it from right and left. We got it during this campaign more from conservatives, I think.
Well, because people do perceive a liberal bias in the New York Times.
Yes, they do. But we got it from the left, too. I mean, fairly late in the campaign when the McCain campaign and Sarah Palin were trying to sort of revive the whole William Ayers issue. We'd done a few pieces early on, but we decided, okay, this is all they're doing in their advertising, and it's in every campaign speech. So we sent a good reporter back to Chicago to do a fuller piece on Bill Ayers and his relationship with Obama, which was pretty tangential, actually. And we put that on the front page, the reasoning being, that everybody's hearing about this, and they're going to turn to the New York Times to find out what's real. But I got a couple of emails from readers who said, why are you dredging up this old stuff? So one even said, are you trying to get Obama assassinated? So we get it, and we get it angrily from both sides.
Well, I was curious about something that I was involved with Bill Ayers, because I moderated a panel with some famous educators, Maxine Green, Herbert Cole, Bill Ayers, for the Stella Adler Acting School. And the Times covered the story as William Ayers. Mm-hmm. The other two famous educators totally ignored. I got into it, the article, only because I asked him if my moderating the panel meant I couldn't run for president. And his answer was, no, it means you – this is before the election. You can and you'll win is what he said. Bill Keller, not William Keller.
No, I'm William on my driver's license, but I've been Bill ever since I had a byline.
Bill Keller wrote the introduction to the complete front pages, 1851-2008, of the New York Times. There are three DVD-ROMs with all 54,267 front pages and links to the full articles. And the book has 300 front pages of the Times. He asked me before we went on the air whether I looked up my birthday to see if I'd made the cut, and I did make the cut, Bill. I'm really upset about that.
Neither did I, by the way.
Although, as we discussed, I've always wondered whether you really want to know about the day you were born or the day after you were born, because that's the day that's covering the day that you were born.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the newspaper business has changed so much. We were talking about the homepage of the New York Times and how that's changing constantly. So how does that affect the makeup of the regular paper?
It means that when you sit down to put together the front page of the printed newspaper, you can't ignore the fact that so much of the actual raw information is known. If the stock market went dramatically down or dramatically up the day before, just that fact is not going to make a compelling news story. You've got to supply something else. You've got to get behind the story and tell people why it happened, if you can, or what the consequences of it are. Or maybe you just want to, you know, not make a big deal out of that particular fact, but go somewhere else on the economy.
A listener wants to know whether the New York Times is considering going electronic full-time the way the Christian Science Monitor has.
No. I mean, could that happen sometime in the future? Probably. When the next generation of college kids takes over the world. Although, you know, historically, I mean, one thing this book shows you is that the Times has been around since 1851. It survived the introduction of radio, which was going to put newspapers out of business, and the introduction of television, which was going to put newspapers out of business. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the next generation of college students will abandon printed newspapers either.
Well, as long as we can get the more complete story, radio and television can't give the kind of story, the kind of depth that a newspaper can or a magazine can. Mm-hmm. But you can do that with your internet edition. Another listener wants to know about that table of contents, which used to be just one page, now is three pages. He says it's a waste of time. Why not let readers just find the news themselves? Others have said that one page table of contents was more than enough.
Mm-hmm. We found that readers are pretty divided about this, which is not unusual. Readers are always divided about any kind of a change. We find that some people actually think that it's useful to get a sample of everything that's in the paper up front, that it tends to lead them to stories that they might otherwise not have gotten to. And other people think, as the person who wrote in said, that it's a waste of time. We did not cut
news. Why
cut
expand it? It almost feels like one of those handout newspapers in itself.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, it's extra space. We did get extra space to do it, so we're not cutting away. We're not taking away anything in the way of coverage that people would have liked. And the idea is to serve as a sort of billboard for all of the treasures that are in the paper.
One listener says that a testament to the power of the front page of the New York Times is that it's impossible to get a copy of the November 5th issue with the headline that simply says Obama.
Mm-hmm. We went back to the printing press three times the next day. I don't run the circulation department, but we urged them to do that. And I believe there is a plan afoot to bundle copies of the election night edition with the inauguration edition in January. So. And there are still copies. It was, considering how much we talk about the death of newspapers, it was sort of sweet to see people lined up down 40th Street the day after to buy copies of the newspaper.
We recently did a segment on this show about the danger of today's fast-paced 24-hour news cycle. Is it harder to report news stories accurately today than it used to be? Because you're caught up in the competition and just the speed of it all.
If you grabbed a New York Times reporter at random and said, what do you worry about? The first thing would be, you know, whether there will be newspapers. But the second thing would be that very question, the tension between the speed of the internet, the demand to do everything right now, and the time for deeper reporting and reflection and writing, too, which, you know, all of those things take time. And they're, I believe, what distinguish us from a lot of other news sources. We've tried to sort of build in mechanisms, a sort of rewrite desk that will relieve reporters from having to act like hamsters on a wheel and just constantly be filing updates so that they have time to go off and do the serious reporting and thinking.
Although we're not seeing the kind of investigative reports we did see in the past in the Watergate era. Well, actually, that was more the Washington Post, but the Times then did a whole bunch of things in its own. We're seeing less of that today, more likely to see those kinds of stories out of the New Yorker.
Oh, I don't agree with you. I mean, I can only speak with any authority to the 5 years or so I've been on this job, but the whole NSA warrantless eavesdropping story was ours. More recently, we broke the Elliot Spitzer story. the fact that the Long Island Railroad tends to retire all of its people into disability payments, so they're essentially getting a second salary. That was our investigative unit. The story that David Barstow did earlier this year on all the military analysts on TV and how and the Pentagon's attempt to co-opt them with special briefings and contracts. We do a lot of investigative reporting. Deaths of immigrants in custody we've been writing about lately. I mean, I can go on and on, but we...
I'm going to apologize right now.
Okay.
Issue a correction.
If you don't, I'll get strung up by our investigative reporters when I get back to the office.
Is there still a big debate over publishing stories with unnamed sources?
There's a kind of running discussion.
How do you get around it?
I mean, it
does lead to some of the problems you've had, like the Judith Miller problem, although I gather she's finally landed on her feet. She's going to be on Fox News.
Right, as an analyst. There are a few sort of purists in the newspaper business who say that newspapers should just forswear anonymous sources altogether. I just think that's high-minded nonsense. There are so many important stories you could not report unless you could protect the people who are willing to provide you the information. The obligation, once you've used an anonymous source or decided you're going to rely on an anonymous source, is to tell your readers as much as you can, A, about how reliable they are, and B, about whether they had an axe to grind.
Would you like to see a federal law that protects reporters more? There are many states have them, but if you write something about what's going on in Washington, you can go to jail.
That's right. Yeah, every state except Wyoming, I believe, has either a law or court precedents that allow you journalists to protect sources, but at the federal level, there is none. I would like to see such a law. I suspect there would be, exemptions built into it that would still cause us conflicts down the line. But yes, I would like to see a law like that.
I'm not sure whether they shouldn't be writing letters to the Times, but a number of listeners have called in to complain about the incorporation of the Metro section into the main news section. And they feel that it's cut back on the number of stories that are making it in there.
It has not cut down on the number of stories or the amount of space or the number of reporters who are devoted to covering the metro area. I took, no pleasure in eliminating the metro section.
Was this just a matter of economics, not printing
purely,
out the section?
Purely a matter of economics. You can print four sections on a press run. If you can get the number of sections down to four, you can eliminate a shift in the printing plant, and you save money without taking anything away from the readers.
That's why we wind up with sports sometimes in back of the business section.
Business section, right.
I would prefer that you put the business section in back of the sports section, Bill.
I'll take that under advisement.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times, and he wrote the introduction to this fascinating book. It really is fascinating. We couldn't go page by page, but it's quite wonderful. The New York Times, the complete front pages, 1851-2008. We had three DVD-ROMs and all 54,267 front pages and links to the full articles. And in the book itself, the printed part, 300 of the most interesting front pages of the New York Times since 1851. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.